from the University at Buffalo School of Social Work. Welcome to the In Social Work podcast. I'm Peter Sabota. It's good as always to have you along. Efforts to raise up diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility aren't new ideas for social workers and our profession. Currently, to say the least, we appear to be in a point in time in which attempts to promote these have fallen into disfavor, and in which colorblindness and meritocracy are on the rise. Today on the podcast, we will meet and talk with Summer Blair, MSW-LISWCP. She's a doctoral student at the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work, the founder of the Parenting for Racial Equity Project, and a former social work practitioner. We wanted to speak with her about a question that she's been exploring in her scholarship, and one that many social work professionals and students have recently been asking some form, and that's, as a white person and as a social worker, how do I show up for and foster solidarity and allyship with people of color? She will share her ideas and opinions on helping white parents raise anti-racist children through an ethnic racial socialization intervention based on what she refers to as critical consciousness. Ms. Blair will describe how whiteness can be explored through white racial socialization and identify strategies for white individuals to become active allies in racial justice. Finally, she will discuss recognizing privilege, dismantling systemic racism, and fostering inclusivity through community engagement, policy, and practice. Hi, Summer. Welcome to In Social Work.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, no. I'm sure you have many other things you could be doing on a Tuesday. A Tuesday here. So we really appreciate you taking the time. And we're continuing our tour of the Pitt School of Social Work. And so we're glad we just had Bailey Nichols on recently. So,
love her.
And so welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Here we go. So let's get right to it, as they say. So just how about this? Let me start this way. And you don't have to agree with this. We appear to be in a time where or in which attempts to promote diversity, equity, inclusiveness have seemingly fallen into big disfavor, and in which kind of colorblindness and merit-based decision making are being promoted. We thought you were doing some really interesting scholarship, and you've already told me when we were just briefly chatting about doing this podcast that you are a white person, a social worker, a doctoral candidate, a partner, and a parent. Am I leaving anything else out?
Well, I hope to be a doctoral candidate very soon. I don't want to mince words, but I have not defended my proposal. So technically, I'm still a student, but we'll see, hopefully soon. But yes, all of those things are right. Those are all roles and identities that are all very important to me.
Is there time to sleep?
No, actually.
No, okay.
especially when your partner is an accountant and it's tax season right now.
Let's not talk about that. So given all that, your research and teaching interests could, I think, kind of be summarized by this question that I think you might be asking. As a white person and a social worker, how do I show up for and foster solidarity and allyship for people of color? Is that fair?
Very fair, yes.
All right. So here it comes. How did you arrive at this question?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I really enjoy getting to share because when you mentioned and listed off all those roles, all of those roles intersect for me. I mean, truly, I am a living embodiment of intersectionality and what that means and what that can look like. And that's really what brought me to the work too. I was a practicing social worker in South Carolina. I was working in different roles within the child welfare system, a little bit case management, a little bit clinically. And I knew I always wanted to kind of pursue a PhD just because I have a love of learning. It's in my history. My family, everyone is public school educators. So teaching and learning has always been really important. But social work called me, and And I knew I wanted to return somehow, but there wasn't really a question in child welfare that I wanted to pursue a lifetime of work on, even though I loved the work I was doing. And I just remember when the murder of George Floyd happened in 2020, my partner is a Black man, and we lived right outside of the Capitol in South Carolina. And so people were protesting, and some people were supporting the protesters, and some people were obviously not. South Carolina is a very red, red, red state, always has been, probably always will be. And I remember we had being an interracial couple, we have a lot of friends that are white. We have a lot of friends that were Black. And I noticed that during this time, a lot of our white friends kind of came out of the woodworks, if you will, saying, "What can I do? Oh my gosh, I feel so bad," and da 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 da, all these things. "You're a social worker," or to my husband, "You're a Black man. Like, what do you need?" Da, 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 da. And while I think the attempt was from a place of you know, a good-hearted place, unfortunately, it made us feel very uncomfortable. Even to my husband, when I was like, "Should we go? You want to go protest?" And it was similar. We were rounding out an extended tax season. Due to COVID and all that was going on then. And he was, you know, finishing these 70, 80 hour weeks. And he was like, "No, it's 110 degrees outside. I don't want to go protest. They can go protest. Like, I've done enough. Like, my lived experience is enough. I shouldn't have to do more, especially in this heat." All that being said, and so that kind of led me to the question. And I immediately, you know, I knew, quote, like, I knew I'm not supposed to ask people to teach me these things. I'm not supposed to ask I worked with most of my colleagues were folks of color. It's not my job to go ask them, what should I do? So I'm Googling and I'm looking, and I just felt like there was a lack of concrete resources. We also at this time began to foster children. So we had a lot of children of color living in our home. And then as being the only white person in a lot of these spaces, it felt like people were taking care of my friends and family of color were taking care of me in this time more than I was even showing up for them. And that felt really wrong. And that felt really misguided. And all of that to say, that is when I knew I could work on this problem. I could work on this problem forever and be very okay with it, because this could be my life's work, because this is so important to me. And that's when I began looking at, what should that look like? How could that look like? And the part of parenting as well came into the play, being a foster parent, both to children of color and to white children. And so that's eventually what led me to the University of Pittsburgh and the Center of Race and Social Problems, where I now do the work that I do under the mentorship of Dr. James Hughley. And I'm so thankful for all of the experiences and the people who came before me that allowed me to end up in this space.
Yeah, well, thank you. So in addition to really all of that, you also ask questions and wonder about how to navigate your role, you know, as not only a social worker and who you are, but I just know from talking with you a little bit that being a person of faith is something that's very important to you. Yeah. And you're wondering about what the role of that is as you kind of put all of these ideas together. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, I'm not, certainly not an expert in this field. So I'll start with that caveat. This is just my lived experience, and what I'm speaking to is very anecdotal to that. Okay. But that being said, being in South Carolina, and not just in South Carolina, but what I've seen and what I've heard is that this is, and the little research that I have done, is that the experience of segregated communities of faith is just pretty common. And it's very prevalent. And so that leaves families like ours, like interracial families, in a tough position in that, okay, so basically who's going to fit in and who's going to stand out? And it's become even trickier, I feel like, because not only do we have this dichotomy of what color you are, but now with the increasing like polarization of politics, that is playing a role in everything as well. As far as, are you going to a church where you believe that you know, the pastor or pastors or the elders or whoever the leaders are of that, you know, congregation, what are they thinking? Are they supporting policies that really help me and help what I look like and help my lived experience and help people? And those type of questions can really send you in a spiral of, because you want to connect with your faith. And also you have certain beliefs and values that you feel like are a direct or could be a direct interpretation of principles of your faith that should be, there's not basically room for wiggle room in that scenario. And so we fortunately have found a community here in Pittsburgh that is really one of the beacons of what diversity and faith can look like. And unfortunately, that's very rare. And even in like a very small preliminary study that I did from interviewing pastors of predominantly a monoracially white church, monoracially black church, and a multiracial church, there's hesitancy with integrating in any of those spaces because of the difficulty, because you want to, quote, reflect your community. And the reality is the communities are segregated. So how are you supposed to, you know, and all those things. So easier said than done, like when you're in more of a metropolis area like Pittsburgh, where there's folks that are all different living maybe in closer proximity. When you get out to suburbs or when you get out to more rural places, it's like, well, I live around all white people, or I live around all black people, or I live around all brown people. So wouldn't that make sense if the church reflects the community that we all still are living in our bubble? And that can be difficult to kind of navigate. So long story short, or long story long, I think the current political climate too, and how especially the rise of Christian nationalism.
I was just going to ask you about that. What kind of, it's, let's put it this way. It's in the discussion. And I have to think their impact. So sorry, go ahead. You really anticipated the question. Go right ahead.
No, I just, and again, we're getting information by the day in it, I feel like, of things that are being passed by the executive branch and all these things. And so we might talk about something, and by the time this podcast is released, it's outdated. I mean, things are happening that quickly.
Right.
And what I am always not fearful of, but I feel like something that I hold in tandem, and something that I've been very fortunate that my colleagues in and around social work, whether in Pittsburgh or elsewhere, have come to understand, is I identify more as a follower of Jesus than as a Christian. Because being a Christian now has been, that term has been molded, exploited, changed,
weaponized. In some cases,
weaponized, yes, to, you know, fuel this anxiety, this victimhood, this fear. And that's just not the principles that I read out in the book of the Bible. Yes, there is times when there's condemnation and judgment and all these things. And ultimately, the big story is one of joy, love, peace, and hope. And that's not the message that I'm receiving when I'm hearing Christian nationalist talk. I'm hearing fear. I'm hearing division. I'm not hearing those things that that I hear about week in and week out. And again, I'm not the expert in this. This is just my lived experience. And I think it's something a lot of Christian social workers are grappling with, because, you know, they might even be hearing from colleagues who aren't, how could you be this and be a social worker? And the reality is, and something that I always stop and say, whoa, slow down, is I do not reflect, and I don't think anyone of any identity should hold, should be the whole spokesperson model for that either. And when we do that thing, when we say, because I know you do, or go to this place or do this thing, I know you believe all this, or you support this person, or you blah, 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 that's a really tricky and like slippery slope you can go down. There's a lot of things that America has done that I do not support as far as our colonization of people, our enslavement of people, and all these things. And am I still an American? Yeah, I am. Like, I think you can hold two things And we get our issues arise when we start thinking binary, when we start thinking no, but instead of yes, and, if that makes sense.
Oh boy, so many questions. Oh, while you were talking, by the way, it reminded me of, I think it was, might have been Martin Luther King who said, what is the most segregated hour of the week? And I think, what is it, like 9 or 11 o'clock on
11.
Sundays, or 11 mm-hmm. o'clock on Sundays? Yeah. And it's really true here in Buffalo, no doubt. And I'm sure probably throughout the country. So given all of that, it got bigger. The whole thing got bigger. What are you exploring and studying in your research?
Yeah. So I'm really passionate and have been for a while about children and now my role as a mother. And all of my work, whether it was my foster children or now my biological children, my drive is how can the world be better for them? So like for my two biracial black white children, how can the world be better for them? And ultimately, you know, they have a plethora of black cousins. They have a plethora of white cousins. How can the world be better for them as well? My nieces, my nephews, the kids we hang out with, the children that are my best friend's kids. So it's not just thinking about just mine. And so, and that's really, that's what drove my work in child welfare. That's what drives my work now. So what I do now is under the mentorship of my research mentor, Dr. Hughley, he started this project several years back called Parenting While Black. And Parenting While Black was a racial socialization intervention aimed for Black families so that they could come together and learn about things like the discrimination their kids would face, to learn about things like the system, systemic racism, and things like that. Things a lot of them already knew.
I was going to say
yeah.
that is baked in for many folks, but go on, please.
But the main message for there was that how do you advocate for your children, especially in spaces of education, when you know this information? Like you already knew this stuff. How do you then become an advocate for your kids when you think something's happening in the classroom, when you think something's happening in the school district, when you think something's happening in your neighborhood, or you want to make a change or that stuff? And
Got
also,
it.
That's just one part of it. I think even the bigger message that they're that of why that group comes together and they're still running programs now is we also just experience joy. We are not defined by our disparities. We are defined by the Black experience is filled with hope and joy and love and family. And these things that we sometimes focus on, especially in research, is all essentially doom and gloom, as my husband likes to say. Like, we are more than this. And we don't like to be defined by this. And so keeping that idea in mind, the University of Pittsburgh also has another institute called the Racial Equity Consciousness Institute. And that's under my other mentor, Ron Adoko. And thinking about those two things, and that's a multiracial space. So this is Black, white, brown, all folks coming together to learn about what racism and how it's affecting us all. I don't know, like the book, The Sum of Us, like How Are We All by Heather McGee. How are we all being affected by this thing? Even white folks, like it's not beneficial for any of us. And taking all those things in mind, running a couple of exploratory studies through some qualitative interviews, doing a huge deep dive into literature, I ended up with this question and then this intervention called the Parenting for Racial Equity Project. And what it does is it's aimed at white parents who want to racially socialize their children, so white kids, on how to be the next generation of anti-racists, how to have these discussions, how to make it not taboo or icky or gross, how it's like an everyday thing. We know it's occurring, you know? And so there's a lot of research on how in Black families, they have to have the talk essentially
of
with
course,
their kids,
yeah.
sometimes at as young as 4 years old about what do you do when a police officer comes up to you? What do you do in these situations? We as white people are not forced to have those conversations with our children because it quote, doesn't affect us. So this intervention, Parenting for Racial Equity Project that I founded is for to say, it does affect you. And this is why your kids need to know. And it's geared towards a range spectrum of folks, maybe folks who have been super interested in racial justice issues their whole life. And maybe folks who are more apathetic and like, I don't know, I think like, I know racism is wrong, but like, why do I need this type thing? And ultimately the draw-in is your kids, this world is becoming increasingly, increasingly diverse. No matter what's going on in politics, you can't stop it. There's people like me and my husband who are making it this way through the children that we have. So that being said, how do you want to prepare your kids? And that's really like, and some people get icky by that. Like, okay, this is gross. Like, we're doing something for white kids so that they feel better about their future. No, I want to pause there because that's not the main goal. The goal is because these kids end up growing up to be adults. And these adults then work and live and perpetuate these systems that we know are inequitable. If they don't know and are instilled in this as children, yeah, sure, maybe they'll go to college or maybe they'll sit in a seminar one day, if it all comes back, about DEI and like all these things, right? And so maybe they will think about these things in the future. Or maybe their parents will tell them, it's not nice to treat people different because of the color of their skin. Yeah, sure. We've all maybe heard some version of that. And how effective was that? Like for me, there was so, even being married to someone who was a person of color, I didn't know half of these things until really diving in. And I certainly didn't know how to have these conversations with children. And so now it becomes, it's really the Parenting for Racial Equity Project is also like at being modeled from RISI, from PWB, which is Parenting While Black. It is, it's about joy. It's about experiencing those things. I had to tangent really quick. I had a mother tell me in one of my sessions, she said that she was pregnant. They were going to find out the gender. The technician says, you're gonna have a boy. And the dad's first response in the room was, oh great, because the world needs another white boy. And that's how kids are being brought into this world, even by those of us who consider ourselves racially progressive. We're teaching these kids to be ashamed of themselves. We're teaching them to be fueled by guilt. We're teaching them that they don't matter. They're part of the problem. And while there might be tinges of that, that's not the message a child should receive. Any developmental psychologist would tell you, like, that is not what's going to fuel them to make decisions to stand in solidarity with people of color in the future. That's what I'm finding it. And it's really hard for some people because it's like, you do have to balance. You should learn about racial privilege because we certainly have it. You should learn about these things as a white person and as a white kid and know these things. And also you can still experience joy. You can still be proud of who you are. We explore those. And I talk to parents about, it isn't some easy answer. It isn't some, people are like, ooh, white identity. And it's like, well, you are white. That is part of your identity. You cannot change that. How can you still experience? Don't you want your children to live and be happy? Yes. Don't you want them to also stand for anti-racist principles? Yes. Well, there's got to be a way to do both. And children should be allowed to experience that. And I'm so thankful for the mentorship of people of color who honestly allowed me to be able to feel this for the first, who gave me permission, if you will. Yeah, we understand your kids hating themselves or you hating yourself, it doesn't help me in any way as a person of color. Like that doesn't fuel any type of action. You feeling guilty or sorry for yourself doesn't help like our cause. That doesn't help disrupt these systems that we're trying to disrupt. And so I've been really fueled by that, and I've been really thankful because I think if it were to just come from me, it would be like, what is this wild white lady saying?
Yeah.
Because I can stand on the foundation that these researchers and community activists of color came before me and did, they opened the door for me in so many ways and opened the door for these white parents to learn and how to do this in a way that might not, and certainly is not always correct, but at least moving in the right direction.
Yeah, you know, you've mentioned this term twice, and I guess I just want to ask you this question. How is what you're talking about similar and or different from anti-racism?
Which part? You mean like the...
Really, your whole perspective that you're laying out, because you sprinkled it in every so often. And my assumption was that a lot of what you're talking about sounds similar to being active, not just talking about something, but doing something different, which is like for me fundamentally what anti-racism is. And it, does that term fit with the work that you're doing, or is it somehow a nuance?
Well, I hope it fits, or else we need a new tagline because our tagline is raising the next generation of anti-racists.
Well, okay, then there you go. I think you just answered the question.
And truly, it's funny because a lot of the white parents who I work with, they see that initial flyer or whatever, they hear, get an email or they're on a listserv and they sign up and they think the first discussion is going to be, how do I talk to my kids about race? Because so many of us don't know how to do that. I want practical, concrete answers about how to have this discussion in an age-appropriate way. And I said, hold on, we'll get to that. You need to know about yourself first. Because they want to jump right into that. And so it's not, our program is 6 weeks. We don't get to a child to talk about race until week five. We get to then week six. How can your family have a, we literally create based off of all the other weeks of curriculum in week six, what is your concrete action plan as a family? And we call it the anti-racist action plan. So what are you specifically going to do? And we take time and consideration in that, because if we jump into it, a lot of those gestures would be very performative. One-off, let me show up, blah, 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 blah. And you need to know, and I think this is true in a lot of different spaces, you got to know about yourself before you can really, you got to go through your own healing. And that's the thing is, and Ron Adoko from RISI does a whole lesson on this. You got to go through your own racial healing, and that includes white people. So you got to deal with that guilt. You got to deal with those things that you've said before and that you've done before, that your parents have said before, that you've heard your uncle say at the Thanksgiving table that you didn't say anything. You got to deal with all that. And there might even be some trauma. Of course, people of color have experienced much, much more extensive racial trauma, and therefore must go through much, much more racial healing. And there's still a part of that with white people too. We can't jump into what you should do until you know who you are and you've reconciled that. And so it really does lead to, and I've had some people say, like, I say, what are the spaces that you're in right now? Are you on the school board? Is your kid in a school district? Is your kid, oh, you homeschool? Okay. Where are they at? Are they in a soccer program? Do they go to music lessons? Like, where do you work? Like, all these different things, you show up in those spaces. If your kid's homeschooled, you don't show up to the school board and say, demand like more anti-racist curriculum when your kid doesn't even go to school. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, it's very performative. You have to show up in places that you're already, any place that you would show up and advocate for your own child. Now you show up and you advocate for people and families and children of color too. Don't do it in spaces that you weren't already in. Don't show up. Don't drive across. This drives me nuts. Don't drive across the city to go to some other park so that your kids can hang out with black kids. Please don't do that. Again, performative. People live closer to you than you think. You don't have to drive across the city. Another thing that people don't even think about, and people have told me multiple times, is I was like, are your kids even exposed? Because so many of us live in bubbles. Are your kids even exposed to people of color? Like, oh, there's the one, you know, one brown PE teacher at school. Okay, so no, that's a no. How then can we, well, I don't know. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, blah, 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 blah. We live in this area and we do these things. Okay, what about things that you do not so often? When you go to the dentist, is your dentist white? You know, there's dentists who aren't white. You know, there's when you have something done on your house, when you need paint done, or when you need a construction project, you can look up and find, but all folks of color who perform those same jobs, you pay them and they do a good job, and your kids see that. Because if you're just talking and you're not doing the action part, not only is that performative to other folks around you're showing your kids it doesn't really matter. And so that even has caused people to stop and think, oh, there are more areas of opportunity than I think, because we're so limited. But if we don't start really like thinking imaginatively about these things, if that's a word, then it can be very consolidated and confining. Like, well, based on what I'm doing, that's what we're trying to change. It can't be based on what you're doing. And I even say sometimes away from the idea of, you know, when we talk about DEI, what's the I? Inclusivity. Listen, most people, from what I've heard, a lot of people of color don't want to be included in what us white folks are doing because we're miserable too. So why would you want to be included in this mess? Instead, why don't we think more expansively? Why don't we think about that and who we expose our kids to or the programs that we do, instead of saying we need to bring people to us or we want to involve more people in what we're doing? Let's change the I to if I can even think right, expansive, an E. Like, think, how can we make, instead of making, fitting more people into our tight bubble, make the bubble bigger, or let's pop it all together. Like, that's an even better idea. We're so, as humans, we just like, it's just easy, especially as parents. We're in this rat race where we're just like on this wheel of, okay, drop off at school, go to work, work, go get make dinner. Da, da, da. And it's like, we don't stop and reflect and think of how can we expand our world? How can we do this for kids? And so when it seems like, oh, I'm hearing these outside voices or the Black Lives Matter movement is erupting and it finally reached my little area, I don't know how to enact these principles that I'm hearing I should do. Because again, you're trying to include it into your little bubble or square instead of thinking, how can I expand myself and my family and what we do? So yeah, that we can change ultimately and fundamentally altogether.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying, I really like and I'm open to change just on my terms.
Right.
So I think you have been talking about this, but I just want to make sure. I think you've been talking about it maybe without naming it, but in some of the things that I've read, you talk about consciousness. And socialization. So I want to ask you about both of those, if we could, for a minute. Could you define them? Could you define both of them, consciousness and socialization, and how they fit into your thinking?
Okay.
It's an hour podcast, Summer. Okay, but no.
I'm going to give you the super layman's term as if I was talking to someone who's not in academia, not even in social work, whatever. And they say,
that's fair.
Hey, what are these two big jargon words that you say that you do? Mm-hmm. When it comes to conscience, oh gosh, can't even say the word. When we're talking about consciousness, ultimately, like, I think of that as just raising awareness.
Okay.
Period. Like, the very simple term. And that's why I think some people who are in anti-racist or attempting to be anti-racist, or folks who are watching others attempt to be anti-racist, sometimes don't love it, because it's like, so you know more, so what? Like, yeah. Do anything? Jamal and Bussey wrote this article in 2018, and I've used that to inform a lot of my work too. Whereas it takes a little bit of a step past, like what Freire did with critical consciousness, and they talk more. This would not be included in the layman's, because this is very heady space.
Okay, we can move into that beyond the layman. I'll go right ahead.
But they talk about a theory called transformative consciousness. So, moving past, okay, so I'm aware of these things, which I do think is the first step, and something that my research mentors, especially in RISI with the Racial Equity Consciousness Institute, that's their goal. You can't do anything about the problem if you don't even know what the problem is. So I echo those sentiments. I think that's true. I understand that, yes, we are all adults and have access to technology. If you wanted to, you can find it. And I even argued to my class yesterday, I said, some people don't even know what to Google, though. Like, they don't even know. Like, most people don't know about systemic racism. Like, they genuinely do not know, especially white people. We do not know. And even people of color who experience internalized racism, because we're in America and we're living underneath these umbrellas of meritocracy and capitalism, and you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I've seen Joe from across the street do it, so I don't understand why you can't. Like, because we live in that kind of mentality and headspace, it is like earth-shattering to hear, oh, there's a system that was put into place that is keeping you where you are on purpose. not unintentionally, on purpose. And I think for some people that is so antithetical to the American experience. That can't be true about America. That's true about other places. It can't be. I mean, we've been instilled these values for so long, starting when the first like textbook or the first time you say the Pledge of Allegiance in kindergarten, right? Like, we all have this opportunity. We all can do it. And so to hear, whether that's when you're a teenager or a young adult or an older adult, whatever, to hear that's not true. There's other stuff going on that's working against you. I think for some people, that's like just wild to think about. And so I think that is where the consciousness part comes into play. You have to know about these things, and it has to be, you have to be made aware of it.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but it's, I think you're going even further than that. So you're kind of talking about consciousness and transformation.
Well, the transformation, I would say, is then the second part, which is kind of what they describe. Like, you can know about it. Okay, so I've been taught all these things, and now I know, and not do anything about it. Like, ultimately, like, well, especially for white people who ultimately say, this doesn't really affect me. Like, this isn't really, like, my issue. So, and that's why, you know, I say this, and it's kind of sad to even bring up, but when I was applying to doctoral programs, and I knew that this was what I wanted to do based on, you know, the history I gave you and such, I had several mentors, even from my, you know, whether that's MSW program or around, that said, you shouldn't study race. It's not for people like you. Meaning,
yeah, I'm not surprised.
Not for white people. You leave that to the researchers of color. Like, and to me, I'm like, I didn't know, I didn't have the words at the time, but I was like, that's wrong. But I don't know why that's wrong. I just know that that's wrong because that's wrong, right? And what I've come to now know and like put being able to articulate now is that's what we do. We do it in research. We also just do it in like our everyday lives for people who have no connection to academia or the institute. It's, we ask people of color to do the work to fix the problem that, quote, we created. Like, that Americans created, that white Americans created, that white male Americans created, like, right? And so I said, and the research all supports this. White people, yes, they have been studied extensively about our medical issues and our mental health issues and what have you. And the one spot where we're studied less, right? Because you read all these studies and it's like, oh, and our sample population was white males age 18 to 42. Well, you know, that doesn't really speak to my experience. I'm a woman. That doesn't speak to my experience as an older adult. That doesn't speak to, you know, my experience as a person of color, whatever. My experience as a disabled person, whatever the case may be. The one area where that's not true is in studies where race is studied. White people are not studied when it comes to race. People of color are studied when it comes to race because we want to talk about the disparities and we want to talk about, oh, look at these poor educational outcomes and look at this, look at this prison, this school to prison pipeline and look at the incarceral system and look at all these things and all blah, 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 blah. And we want to, that's when we want to study people of color. That's when it becomes interesting and vogue too. And to me, that's so sickening because it's like, okay, we're not going to include people of color in research where it can affect positive outcomes. We just want to continue to do exploratory studies where we talk about how bad things are and there's no solution offered at all.
Yeah,
we write a recommendation section that says, and in the future, we should think about how we should blah, 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 blah. Who's actually doing those things?
Yeah, well, I think that's also a function of when whiteness gets basically conceptualized as the norm, what's normal. Mm-hmm. And everything that isn't white is something to pay attention to. Or is somehow a shiny object. You know, it's you know, I don't know what it is today. I'm coming up with quotes as I'm listening to you. But while you were talking, I remember watching, I think they were talking to, it might have been Toni Morrison, the author. And I don't know if this was around the time where George Floyd was killed. But in a sense, they were asking her to provide, you know, like sage commentary or advice. And she just simply said, you know what? No news to me. This is a white person's problem. Don't ask me. Don't ask me to figure it out. And I think that's true. I think that fits very much with what you said. Let's not forget about socialization.
Yes.
Let's not leave that out of the mix.
Here.
Yeah. What do you think? What are you talking about there?
Socialization, you know, I study racial socialization. And so it's how do we send implicit and explicit messages to our kids about race?
Mm-hmm.
So implicit and explicit. And I think the reason why racial socialization research until the last 5 years or so was so scarce for white people was because, you know, there's this seminal article that was written in 2006 that defined what racial socialization is. And it uses that definition. And it's by Hughes, and anybody who studies race is familiar with this article. It's very, very, you know, in the academic world, you know, cited all the time. And so people took that definition and ran with it and said, because what they did is they had the original definition, which was implicit and explicit messaging. But then they broke down what that can look like in different spaces. And for them, some of the things that they talk about, there's like four or five different categories. One of them is preparation for bias, right? Well, white people don't have to prepare their kids for bias. So boom, that doesn't count. Mm-hmm. Another one was something that's like a more minute category was something about like silence about race. Okay, well, that doesn't really apply to people of color. And I'm like, ding, 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 that applies to us, white people, that applies to us. But because it wasn't considered in the main categories, it was like, that sometimes happens, blah, 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 blah. And so what ended up happening is, so for like the next decade or so, people would use those different categories, which talked about bias and discrimination and those things, and say, oh, so racial socialization isn't happening in white families because they don't have to have these conversations or face these different obstacles that we know families of color are going to have to face. And some people still adhere to that. And some people like myself, so I'm not saying one's right and one's wrong. I'm just saying there's differences of opinions. Some people might like myself say, well, if you go to the definition, before you start going to the breakdown of the categories, the definition is just implicit and explicit messaging about race. For white folks, we often don't have the explicit messaging, aka the direct conversations with our kids, but we're doing the implicit. Everyone's doing something. You know, you're sending some type of message all the time. And so some of us argue that racial socialization in white families has been happening all along. It's not happening in the way that promotes anti-racism, like you and I have been talking about, but it's happening. It's promoting this idea of, you know, what some people were searching for a new term besides color blindness, because that's a very ableist term, but this color blindness, right? Like there's messaging being sent. Everybody's equal underneath the eyes of God. Yes. And right. It's like, or if you work really hard, you'll have better outcomes. Yes. And like these other things are like, but we're only getting that first part of the messaging a lot of times. Like, even for those of us who have been raised by parents who taught us to treat everyone equally. Yes, and they're not being treated equally by all systems and by all people. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like we're not finishing, if you will, the idea there. And so we just did, me and my mentor just did a huge literature review of all these different things, especially for white families, about how they're racially socializing. And we came up with new categories because our idea is these categories that were created in 2006, almost 20 years ago, were ultimately, while there were some white families included in the study, they were ultimately created with families of color in mind, because that research has been going on since the 70s or 80s.
Mm-hmm.
There was very little thought into what would these categories look like if they were specific to the messaging that white families sent.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we're kind of reconceptualizing what racial socialization looks like. And then ultimately, like, and that's what I tell families, because we have a whole lesson, that's one of our other lessons of the six on racial socialization during the Parenting for Racial Equity Project, is if you listen to nothing, if you take nothing, you are still going to be racially socializing your children, period. Mm-hmm. It's going to be happening. Now, if you take maybe some of the things that we're talking about as I facilitate this group, you might be able to shift, change, transform the messaging to be more anti-racist for your kids. And so now you're racially socializing your kids in a different way, but it's still going to happen whether you choose to listen to any of this or not. Because I think some people think if I just put it out of sight, out of mind, then my
Right.
kids, you know, they're not learning to be racist, because obviously I'm not saying those things. I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying like white, I don't say things like white people have it easier. I'm not saying these things. And it's like, but your implicit messaging, things that you're not saying, are speaking even louder. And that's one of the biggest parts of all the research is in white racial socialization, is that kids, parents will say, all, even again, most of these studies are done with really racially progressive parents. And they'll say, I believe blah, 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 all these different like anti-racist principles. I believe systems do impact people of color. I believe blah, 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 I believe blah, blah, blah. And then you give the survey to the kid, and the kid doesn't match the adult. The kid doesn't think those things. The kid does think that children of color in their class aren't as smart, or tend to be misbehave more, or they do think these things. And so then it's like, and so when white parents then see their kids' survey results, they're like,
They're mortified, yeah.
my gosh, how is this happening? I don't understand. And it's because, but the ultimate, and I love to point out this, the crux of the question on the kids' surveys will be, do you think your parents think the same thing as you? And the answer is always yes. In fact, I believe these things because my parents believe them. And so it's not what parents believe that affects their children. It's kids' perceptions of what parents believe that affects the kids. And so you could be talking, you could think till you're blue in the face, all these wonderfully positive, racially progressive, super just, super equitable things. If your kid doesn't perceive you as that way, they don't believe those things. They're modeling based off of what they perceive you to believe. And I think that hits parents really hard. Because it's like, oh, I guess I haven't really verbalized those things. I guess I haven't really demonstrated through my actions that I do adhere to these values. I guess I haven't. And it's like, well, if you're not modeling that explicitly, then what do you think is going to happen? And so that's really the biggest like aha moment. And one of the best examples of that, when people want, again, people want concrete examples. White people are really concerned with having their kids have diverse group of friends. Oh, we put them in this soccer program so that they could, you know, and they're the only white person, or we specifically chose the school district even, or like some people really are trying to make efforts to increasingly racially diversify their kids' world. Cool. That's not a bad thing. However, research doesn't explicitly support that that's going to lead to any better outcome. It could, but it's just not yet supported. What is supported is parents, peer groups, parents, friends lead to kids having less racially biased attitudes. Parents, friends. So the kid could literally have all white friends, but if their parents, friends, or family that are people of color who they love and support, who come into their home even, that's what makes a difference. And so, and people ask me, why do you think that is? Like, why are my friends, why is my group more important than my kids' group? And I say it goes back to kids are, whether subconsciously, like idealizing what their world is going to look like as an adult, right? So this like happy-go-lucky, like, you know, oh, we're all friends here in kindergarten or in second grade or even in middle school, like whatever. When we're all forced to sit together in a cafeteria, you know, or when we're all
Yes,
forced to play
when
on
we
the,
have no choice.
when we have no choice. Oh, but I see. And again, they're probably not thinking this consciously, subconsciously. Oh, but I see. When you get to a certain age, you live around people who look like you. You're friends with people who look like you. You don't associate with people who don't look like you. All of that stops. And Beverly Taimon and Why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? I don't know if you know that book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. She
Actually, I watch that book in action on a fairly regular basis, unfortunately.
Well, and she mentions at some point, you know, kids of color, like adolescents, they get to a point where it's like, we've been friends with white people for so long. And then we get to like high school where we're really starting to conceptualize like how,
yep.
Oh, my lived experience is different than yours in many different ways. And it's not okay. And then you're trying to articulate these things to your white friends and they're not, right? They're not getting it. Like, no, we're all the same. We go to the same school. No, it's the same. We play in the same band. No, it's all the same. Like, because that's how we've raised our white kids, right? Like, we're all the same. We're all equal, blah, blah, blah. So that's obviously what they're going to verbalize to their friends of color once their friends of color come to them and say, I'm having a really hard time. I think that teacher said something to me that was not okay. Or I feel really like, you know, they, when you said that joke, it hurt my feelings. Oh, you're being sensitive. Blah, blah, blah. Like, and that's where the ripple effect starts to occur. Right.
Yeah.
Even if you've had friends of color as a kid, adolescence and young adulthood is when we start to like kids start to really conceptualize and concrete their ideas.
Or identity, if you will.
And really really solidify their identity. It's like, oh, you don't get me. Because we've been this surface level thing for a long time. And now that we're like moving into adulthood, now that we're really like identifying ourselves and how we stand, now it's not the same. And that's when this like splice occurs.
I wanted to ask you, because you're doing this all in the context of social work.
Yes.
The last thing, if you'd like to comment on this, what are you hoping for will be the impacts and what are the implications for, I'll cast a broad net and you can pick, you know, social work practice, education. Yeah, let's just leave it at that.
Let me start off by saying this. I think our research and our teaching and our education, it doesn't make it to the quote real world fast enough. And so that's one of the first things that I'm hopefully and actively fighting against. I want my research to be disseminated to people. And that's why all of my projects are community-based. I partner with a community partner. I go into a community center and do these things. I think that's number one, because I want these principles to be acted out in real life white families, right? I want their kids to know these things and I want them to end up growing into, and I think that's what social work research sometimes miss. It's like, oh, it's cute if you're a community-based researcher. That's cute. And it's like, no, we should all be that. Like, it shouldn't be something that you are or you aren't. It should be just a part of who we all are. That's my opinion. And that's how you get the research to folks faster instead of this 17-year gap or whatever. That's where I would say with research. So actively, literally, if you will, like injecting the vaccine of anti-racism into communities. I might not be changing the whole world, but I'm changing the world of these few people. Like, that's kind of the goal with the research. With the education, especially what I'm seeing with my students in like MSW programs and things like that, it's specifically I'm thinking about like white social workers and what they're doing and how they're showing up, not just for their clients or their communities of that they're serving, not just of color, but also white clients in white communities, but also for those like colleagues of color around them. So when I say that, I mean, I have so many students who are grappling with this like racial identity crisis, if you will, that are white, who are like, ah, I'm throwing off all the whiteness, I'm getting rid of it. And like, blah, 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 blah. And it doesn't, well, again, heart in the right place. However, it ends up one seeming sometimes inauthentic to like, you know, communities. And it's like, but we know you're white. So you aren't like me. So, and that's okay. You just, but don't pretend, you know, like, so that's where it comes off as inauthentic. And then for white clients and communities they're serving, and I've seen this as I grade papers and stuff where they're reflecting on experiences, they're very jaded and biased towards white communities and white clients. Oh, this white man, of course he's acting this way because he's so privileged and blah, blah, blah. And he's coming to you for therapeutic services, you know?
Yep.
And it's like, but we're so aware because we're teaching these things in our education, in our social work education curriculum about how to work with diverse clients and communities. Okay. I'm aware as a white person that when someone comes in who's different from me, whether in sexual orientation or race or whatever, able-bodiedness, I'm aware of those things and I'm going to be okay with it. Like, it's like, but as soon as someone confronts us with our own whiteness, it's as white folks, it's like, we want to be like, no, absolutely not. Like, And that's hurting the client and communities as well. Like,
Yep.
we're not recognizing our bias towards people who even look like us. We're recognize our bias. We're taught to recognize our bias of folks who are different. But that I still feel like I'm seeing that bias maybe not show up quite as, but very similarly for people who look just like you. And I'm like, again, hurting someone else doesn't lift someone else up. There's no like benefit in that.
Well, I think the implications for what you're saying, and I think, you know, this almost goes without saying, but I usually say it anyway, is the implications here are huge because social work is an incredibly white profession. And, you know, how you can't ignore that context. You know, that's the implicit piece that you've been talking about. We are it. We're kind of at the end of our, no, we are at the end of our time here. But I want to thank you. But before I do, is there anything that you want to like insert in here that we didn't get to? I know we could probably have gone on and on, but is there anything you want to insert in here before we say goodbye?
I think just to reiterate like one more time that there's probably some things even today that I said that are incorrect. I'm not 100% perfect. I don't know, like, you know, not incorrect as in like factually, but as far as I always come from a place of learning. And so what I, and a growth mindset. So what I said today, I'm going to continue to build upon, and I'm going to continue to research, and I'm going to continue to talk to people. And I think for some white people, their issue is they want to know everything and they want to be completely prepared before engaging in conversations like this that you and I just had.
Yeah.
Or before having those conversations with their kids. And it's just like, stop trying to be perfect. You're never going to be 100% there, and just be willing and able to accept and receive feedback. And, you know, that's hopefully I'm living and practicing what I'm asking others to do as well.
Well, I you know, I was just about to say that. I think, you know, it's one thing to kind of have the conversation, but it's also in my opinion, at least for whatever my opinion is worth here, it's another thing for you to come onto a podcast and have your ideas recorded and to have them put out there, you know, with your name attached to them. So I think it's a, for whatever, again, it's worth, a noble and brave perspective to have. Summer, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again to Summer Blair for taking the time to talk with us. The In Social Work podcast crew is Steve Sturman, our technology and web guru, Ryan Trofe, our GA production assistant and nudger in chief. Say hi, Ryan.
Hello.
And I'm Peter Sabota. I'm going to take the time to remind you that we have about 14 years of podcasts on all sorts of things social work on our webpage at insocialwork.org. If you can't find something that interests you there, you're probably not interested. See you next time, everybody.